cliffcentral.com. The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us in the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Starting with a bit of a special song for this special occasion. Is it the dawn of a new era for America with President Hillary Clinton, or is it the beginning of the Hunger Games with upcoming President Donald Trump? We will find out soon enough. Before we get to that, Greg Nicholson, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you.
I'm doing really good, pretty excited. We have somebody on the ground in America that we haven't, you know, had before, which is pretty excited. We have Ranjeni Munusami, who's usually with us talking all things ANC and state capture on this side, and now is on the ground in Pittsburgh. Ranjeni, can you hear us?
Hello, Kingsley.
How are you doing? How's things over there?
Oh my gosh, it has been so mind-blowing. You know, we've just come out of an election cycle in South Africa. So I thought, you know, well, you know, an election campaign is an election campaign. Let's do this. You know, Washington, I got there a week and a half ago. I mean, yeah. And that was, you know, pretty tame. There were election events there that was pretty tame. Mm. But then I got to Pennsylvania, which is a battleground state, and then I've been to the Republican and Democrat rallies, and it has been absolutely astounding. It has opened my eyes to an America I never knew existed. But on Sunday I went to a Trump rally.
I mean, we've heard so much about this. I'm so curious to have somebody who's not been in that environment, never been to a Trump rally. What was it like? What happened?
Well, this Trump rally was in an airport hangar in Pittsburgh's just off from Pittsburgh's main airport. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, it would be basically campaign events are very compressed. So okay. Clinton's one on Friday had about 2,500 people, and that's generally what happens. You know, okay. It's very contained. It's not kind of mass rallies like we have back at home. Okay. You know, we have an entire stadium. But the Trump rally, when we got there late afternoon on Sunday, there were already a long queue of cars, and the queue of people, you know, waiting to get into the venue was already snaking right around the block. So eventually, about 9,000 people turned up. They said there were about 3,000 people waiting to get in. They couldn't fit into the venue. But it was like a religious event, you know, it was like an evangelical kind of revival. It was amazing because, you know, these people really and truly believe Donald Trump is going to be their savior. He's not just their political leader. They don't believe that he is just going to be president. They think that he is going to change America. He's going to turn the establishment upside down, but that he's going to impact on their own lives. He's going to make, you know, their own families better. They're going to, you know, he's going to basically come into their homes, you know, change their jobs. And he promises to make them rich and wealthy. He promises, you know, that their towns and their cities are going to be changed dramatically. So, you know, it's way different. The atmosphere is way different from what you would ordinarily find at a political rally. Mm. There's a lot of children and a lot of teenagers, which also surprised me. You know, I had this impression that it's kind of a middle-aged, you know, white voters that support Donald Trump. And yes, they're all white. I was the only black person in that venue, which really scared me. There is also a lot of hostility against the media. Mm. From the moment I walked in there, people shout at you. You know, while they're standing in the queue, they shout at you. And while you pinned into an area, designated area for the media, and throughout, people insult you. You know, they call you names. So it was really scary. You know, as a journalist, I've never experienced anything like that.
I mean, a lot of the think pieces and that we read about Trump and his campaign, they talk about sort of this white middle-aged America and a lot of men who feel like sort of things have escaped them with the Obama presidency, with the increased focus on diversity, that they see the Trump campaign as a chance to sort of reclaim their place in the social hierarchy. Did you get that sense on the ground?
Yes, there is that sense, but it's not just a sort of aging white men. While there are many of those, there's a startling number of women. They have their own banners which say "Women for Trump," and they believe that Mr. Trump has just been treated rather unfairly. They believe that he is a good human being, that he has given up his time. They keep saying things like, you know, he's a rich businessman. He doesn't need things like this. He's doing this for us. He wants to make our lives better. He loves America so much. And look, there's a heavy leaning on America's the military history, the wars that America's engaged in, the veterans that have fallen, the veterans that have served their country. They believe that this is a kind of new mission for them, for the veterans of America to stand up now against their own establishment. And even that is quite frightening, because many of these people, and I've seen signs around the Trump rallies that says, that say keep calm and carry guns, and things like that. So, it's really worrying what will happen from tomorrow when the results come out. Because I think it's pretty clear that Hillary Clinton will win unless there is a major upset today, and unless all the polling has got it wrong. But when you see that kind of passion on display, where men and women and children turn out in large numbers, are so emotional about this election, you have to wonder what happens from tomorrow. How do they go on with normal lives? You know, how do they just kind of click back to who they were before this campaign started, and accept Hillary Clinton as the new president?
I mean, I'm thinking about the messaging that the different candidates are going into this final day with. You said you've been to both rallies on both sides, and are they focusing more on a hopeful message? Are they focusing more on the doom and destruction that happens if they don't win? Are they insulting each other, or are they more focused on the individuals themselves? What themes are you seeing in terms of their messaging?
Well, there's a very different texture to the Republican and Democrat rallies. Hillary Clinton, in the last lap of her campaign, was trying to focus more on a positive messaging, saying that she will be the president of all people, not only just the people who voted for her. And last night, for example, there was a massive rally in Philadelphia with Clinton appearing with President Bill Clinton and her daughter Chelsea, as well as President Obama and Michelle Obama. It was quite spectacular. Her messaging and all their messaging there was kind of an embracing message, that, they can kind of heal the United States after such a polarizing campaign. But the feel at the Republican rallies are completely different. There's a lot of insulting. There's a lot of vitriol. Donald Trump is constantly on the attack against Clinton, against the Democrats, against the media. That has been really, really shocking. It is how much Donald Trump has blames the media for the way the campaign has unfolded. He believes he's been treated unfairly. He believes the polling is all wrong and that he is going to win. He believes the system is rigged and therefore the results won't be an accurate reflection of people's vote. It's a different texture, and I think the feeling that the Republican and Democratic voters go to the polls with today is going to be very different. People are voting for very different reasons.
Ranjini, we've heard a lot about how important it is for the candidates to win in battleground states like Florida, North Carolina, Iowa, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, just to name a few. Now, you're in Pennsylvania. What sort of have your conversations been like with just average voters around Pittsburgh?
Well, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh are the major urban areas in Pennsylvania, and there's a strong presence of the Democrats, and they tend to vote blue, Philadelphia particularly is quite strongly Democrat. But Pennsylvania has been Democratic voting generally, but the entire area in between, and it's not really rural areas, but places outside the major urban areas are very, very red, and that's what you see as soon as you drive out of the cities. You find very strong Trump support, supported in these areas. There's one woman just outside of Pittsburgh who's converted her entire house into a Trump house. She's erected this massive cardboard cutout of him outside a house, and people have been coming from thousands and thousands of people have been flocking to this area just to take pictures at this house. And some people have actually come to take their Christmas card pictures outside this house. That is the dedication to Donald Trump. So it's been a difficult state to read in this election, and that is why there's been such a high presence of the candidates here. Mike Pence, Trump's running mate, has been in and out of Pennsylvania. I was surprised that Trump came on Sunday, but I think he believes that he can swing Pennsylvania red. And Clinton has been here twice in 3 days. So they do believe that that a massive turnout, I think, will change the voting patterns of the state. And Trump really believes that the push from the areas outside the urban centers in Pennsylvania will change the state to the Republican.
It really feels like, with this election being so polarizing, that just the divisions within American society must be palpable there. Is that sort of how it feels, or beyond everything we see on TV and the newspaper headlines, is everything sort of, quite normal?
Oh, no, Greg, it's anything but normal. It's it's an extremely abnormal situation, really, because people are so impassioned about this election. On Clinton's side, particularly among women voters, this is a major deal for them, to have a woman in the White House. And, there's a sense of history about this. But there's also, big issues for them, such as equal pay for women and child care and preserving access to affordable health care. So there's, for them, it's to preserve the lives they have, the respect that they have. And also, for the gay community in the United States, they are also, the people that I've spoken to, they seem rather desperate that that the achievements and that that have been made in the U.S. are not reversed, and there's a real fear, particularly amongst Hispanics, that that their lives might change dramatically under a Trump presidency. They don't know what it will all mean, what these threats of a wall and mass removal of immigrants and the prevention of immigrants coming into the country. They don't know what all of that means. So, it's a high-stakes game for them as well. But as I say, on the Trump side, it's a different matter altogether. Yeah. They believe that their lives are going to change completely. When they say make America great, I kept asking this question, what do you mean? What is great? And the great they're talking about, I mean, some of them say it's at the time of Abraham Lincoln. Others say it's that America was great in between the 1950s and the 1980s. And that's the America they want back. Now, for the rest of America, that's rather scary because, you know, at that time, people did not have the liberties that they have now. But for Trump supporters, that is what they want. Mm. They want a state where there's an imbalance in life so that basically white people in particular, middle-class white people such as them, you know, enjoy privileges that other people do not have and that the system favors them. Working class white people in this country as well have felt that you know that they have lost jobs, industries have closed, and that their lives have gotten worse. And they believe that Trump is out there batting for them, and his presidency will see a shake up of the industrial sector, the reopening of factories of in areas such as Pittsburgh, the steel factories, and the, you know that the people who are unemployed, and there isn't as high an unemployment rate as we have in South Africa, but they believe you know that there will be a generation of wealth, not just a creation of jobs.
And Jenny, the more and more you talk and the things you're describing, especially from Trump's side, I can't help but think that you will come home with a very different perspective on South African politics. I don't think you perceive it as crazy as we sometimes make it.
You know, when I left home, I was so despondent and afraid because, you know, when I left home, Pravin Gordhan was still about to be charged, and I didn't know, you know, with my the few rands that I was coming to what they were worth, you know, whether I would be able to survive in the United States or if our rand was going to tank completely once Pravin Gordhan appeared in the dock. But yes, you know, I've been watching what's been going on at home and, you know, particularly the march to Tswane. And, you know, I think, yes, I do have a new kind of hope that things are not as bad as we think they are in South Africa, that basically the whole world is really messed up. Sometimes people have this vision of the United States being utopian, you know, being the kind of vision that we see in the movies and in our favorite serials, and you know that it's all about Hollywood and you know, people live generally good lives, and then there's all this political theater going on, and it's just entertainment. But it's really terrifying for people here, you know, what can happen to their country under both presidencies, because under Trump presidency, I think the way of life will change completely for Americans, and I think that America's relationship with the world will change completely. Under a Clinton presidency, there's so much divisiveness and polarization that I think, you know, that the ethos of the country has been shredded, and people don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty about what happens. There's also fears about perhaps there could be violence and, you know, some people rejecting the outcome of the election. And, you know, when you look at what we've been through back home, you know, we came through a very divisive local government election campaign. There was violence, but we dealt with it as grown-ups. And we survived it, you know, and our democracy strengthened. So, yeah, I have greater appreciation for how we engage in South Africa after what I've seen here.
Okay. And Anjani, before we let you go, you mentioned that the polls are pointing to a Clinton win. So if you just speak a bit more on that, and also when do we expect the major results to start trickling in?
The polls will open soon, and it will go on till about 8 p.m. tonight. So you know, because of the time changes from the East Coast to the West Coast, the last polls close at 11 p.m. So we should have basically a lot of the networks will start calling the results from around, you know, as they come in from the various battleground states from 8 p.m. here in the U.S. And by 11 p.m. Here, you know, we should have some sort of sense of the final outcome, unless there are major there's major contestation in the battleground states, and that's so basically by tomorrow morning, as dawn breaks in South Africa, we should know.
Okay, I'm on the edge of my seat here. I don't know what else to say. I suppose good luck.
Yes, it's a big day in the U.S. I'm a bit apprehensive as well, you know. I'm not as invested as other people are here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there are major repercussions for the entire world, so we all have to pay attention.
Absolutely. And Jenny, thank you so much for chatting to us.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Okay, perfect. That's from Jenny Musaumi, Daily Maverick Associate Editor, who's in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, as we speak, covering the elections. Greg, aside from the craziness and talking about Trump grabbing crotches and all the other fun things he's doing.
That was wild.
What, yeah, that.
And this guy still is in contestation to be president of the United States of America.
Absolutely.
Didn't Mitt Romney lose on his, like, one of the key reasons, Mitt Romney lost was winning that debate. He says he has files of women. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, that
seen as sort of his sexist... you know, orientations.
Yeah, and that was enough.
Well, that was a key point in that elections where, you know, he sounded, in terms of like he lost the woman vote and he sounded ridiculous, right? Trump has said far, far more outlandish stuff, but I guess that's what makes him Trump, right?
Yeah,
that's what
we're seeing. I think it actually makes him stronger in weird ways. And on our side, we've actually had quite the roller coaster also. I remember, I mean, just after we went off air last week, there was a lot of conversations around the state capture report. Will it be released? Will it not be released? Would Zuma's legal team make sure it couldn't be released? And there was this massive, massive buildup. And then before you had it, before you know it, the thing we've been talking about for so long, the Thuli Madonsela legacy, some might say, was eventually released. Do you remember that sort of buildup in anticipation in going into the courtroom?
No, it was hectic. So I think now talking about the state capture report and local politics here, just after hearing Ranjeni speak about just the craziness that's happening right now across America. It definitely does seem, you know, like, it doesn't
we'll
quite seem as extreme,
we'll
right? But no, definitely. So I wasn't in the courtroom that day. I was on the streets with the economic freedom fighters marching around Pretoria, Tswana CBD. And even then, you just had this feeling that, you know, something big is about to happen. So inside the courtroom, the lawyers for opposition political parties were fighting Jacob Zuma, President Zuma's attempt to interdict the state capture report from release. And so this time I'm running around, it's so hot around the streets there, and these guys are, you know, some of like just... They split up into all these different groups, the EFF supporters, and shut down the whole city on all the different sort of entrances and exits. And so you're running around with them, running around with them. And then... At some point while I'm running around doing this, I didn't think the court issues would end that day. And then I just get told that, no, actually, President Zuma has withdrawn his application to interdict the release of this report. And so I'm asking, so what happens now? And then about 20 minutes later, someone says something like, it's going to come out by 5 p.m. today. And it's like what?
I think we all were like, what do you mean today? Yes,
you
today.
Mean today? Yeah. It was almost like everyone wants this report to come out. The media, of course, journalists, civil society, and just... politically active citizens
absolutely.
Have been so keen to just see what this thing says because it's been building up for so long. But then when we heard it's going to come out within a few hours, I was like, we're not ready.
Yeah,
wait, what?
Like, we need more time.
I need to be sitting in the office with a coffee and a highlighter or something like that, right? So then, of course, the sort of nation eagerly awaited the release of the report and... the public protector's office, which is obviously has a new public protector, they released the report online at I think about 4 p.m. or something like that, a little bit before their deadline. And obviously everyone immediately was just scanning the report and the key sections of it to see what was included. And I think the initial reaction to the report was somewhat muted, I think, with, I think people were hoping, or critics and stuff like that, and even those who just like drama, because it's built up so much, everyone was sort of expecting, after, you know, a few months of investigations, after what Public Protector Thuli Madonsela found in her Nkandla report, into upgrades of President Zuma's home, I think everybody was expecting... a huge blow for the president, a decisive blow that could end his leadership. And I think on both sides, people were quite, from President Zuma's supporters and President Zuma's opposers, I think both sides were quite anticipating, that people were anticipating that this could be really decisive for the president, but perhaps he heard winds that it actually wasn't so bad, and that's why perhaps he withdrew his instinct.
I didn't think of that. That's interesting.
But no, I think some of the report's key findings, so I think there were, a lot of it was sort of already been in the public domain, but I think that having a public protector's report on this issue now, and we've seen the impact of the public protector's reports can have after what happened with the Nkandla report. I think that has really, really, it's been a big change for our politics at the moment, and pushed Zuma's opposition much further into their attempts to remove him, right? So, but just to go over some of the brief findings.
Please, yeah.
You know, I think one of the key ones was that there was sort of no evidence indicating that the president or any of the executive really looked into these claims that Deputy Finance Minister Lubisi Jonas or Faki Mentor made they'd been offered posts by the Gupta family, offered cabinet positions in exchange for some sort of other rewards, and then they would obviously have to perform favours for the family. So I think that one was one of those key things, because that definitely does just look like an outright violation of the law if there hasn't been any investigation of what was reported as a crime. Then I think we also have a lot more detail on issues of people like Mosman Zizwani, the mineral resources minister, and certain other ministers and sort of government leaders on their close relationship with the Gupta family.
Being there, what is it, 7 times in 7 days?
That's right.
Or something
that's
crazy,
right. Yeah, like I think
that.
In particular, I don't think anyone really, I guess we could have predicted this if you thought about it, but no one really was like thinking that Eskom CEO Brian Molefe would come out as the sort of the real villain of the state capture report. Because what Tuli Madonsela did do is she looks quite in depth at how the Gupta-linked company ended up buying Glencore's Optimum Mine, and then the contracts that Tegeta then got with Eskom, and all of these sort of murky details that sort of happened in then that really does look like, number one, that Eskom, led by Brian Molefe, who she established, has a very, very, well, quite a close relationship with the Gupta family. And then obviously all of that came out, Saxon Shabin nonsense and whatnot. But what it looks like, at least from the public protector's side, is that Eskom almost made this mine of Glencore's, you know, this mining giant's mine, almost unusable and forced it into rescue. And then they basically ensured or engineered that Tegeta would be able to take it over with the minister traveling to Switzerland to help negotiate this deal. And then they also ensured that Tegeta would get up and running with millions and millions and millions of prepayments and certain things like that. So that, I think, has been one of the key fallouts in the last few days, at least of the actual details of the report. It's really come down hard on Brian Molefe and Eskom. We saw last week when he got quite teary, and he's been quite defensive in his responses to the media so far.
I mean, I think you're right. I think a lot of this stuff we did know, but I think it's different when the Office of a Public Protector, which we now all respect and hold in such high regard, and are all perceive it to be very neutral and very professional, comes out and gives the hard facts that this person was in Switzerland on this day for this, and the cell phone tower shows that you were here on this day and on this. So, I mean, I think you're right. There's just another layer of I wouldn't say seriousness, but I'd say you're right. I'd say that the walls are definitely closing in on those implicated in the state capture.
And I think it's not just those implicated in the state capture report, because we've seen such a long and gradual build-up of opposition to President Zuma and his allies. And in general, he's been able to get away with most of the allegations against him and come out sort of apparently unscathed. We saw what happened with the Nkandla report, and we saw what happened when the Gupta family landed their guests at the Vortklub air base. But at the moment, I think things are just building up to a very heated and like things are coming to a head in terms of those who support Zuma and those who don't. So if you think about the ANC at the moment, we've seen all of these veterans, all stalwarts, you know, some of both, step out and really sort of question the current leadership of the ANC. We've seen Jackson Dembele call for the whole NEC, including the president and himself, to resign. We've seen a senior parliamentary member, Mutole Mocheka, this weekend, basically say that they must ask President Zuma to step down and have Cyril Ramaphosa step up. We've seen the Union Nahau also say that President Zuma should resign. We're seeing this sort of build up, and then you've also got obviously within the ANC people like the Gauteng provincial leadership who are very, very against Zuma's leadership.
Absolutely, I think they were at the Save SA march, which is pretty much against Dave Kirchner.
And so we're seeing, I think, with as the evidence or the implications of wrongdoing and maladministration mount, we're seeing the opposition forces grow and swell, and then that's just within the alliance. Obviously, the SACP is really questioning the president at the moment. But then outside of the ANC, we've also got, you know, remember what happened to the EFF and how they responded to the Nkandla report. They caused, you know, they did not let the issue go.
That's where payback.
They shut down the National Assembly again and again and again. They marched on the streets. We've seen the DA just continually sort of more. Not in terms of action, but you sort of raise its voices and just my money. We've just seen him pillory President Zuma every single chance he gets. And this week, and I think you see what the DA is trying to do right now. This week they're going, they're hoping to discuss the a motion of no confidence in the National Assembly for President Zuma. Obviously, what's going to happen is the ANC, once again, when these motions appear, the ANC will rally around the president because, you know, they don't want to be told by the opposition what to do. But then that's going to smear the ANC worse because now, you know, it's now they
will
all
the
like,
people who defended this person.
That's right. And so the DA will now be able to taint them with the same brush.
I think finally, I'm just curious about on the report specifically, on the recommendations. Do you see that still being an important part of the process, it going through having a sitting judge going through it and going deeper into some of the findings? Or do you think this, what we've heard so far, is enough to really cause a lot of issues?
No, I think what plays out now will be really interesting. Okay. Obviously, so that was the key recommendation that Madan Saleh left, is that a commission of inquiry be appointed with the Chief Justice appointing a judge to lead that commission of inquiry, Treasury giving adequate resources, and also this commission having the same sort of subpoena and evidence-gathering powers as the Office of the Public Protector. Now, if that goes ahead, sort of barring a review or sort of we'll see what happens, or a court challenge to the Public Protector's powers to actually set the terms of a commission of inquiry, because that usually falls under the presidency's responsibilities. I think either in a review, or if this what seems like there will be a quite independent inquiry will go ahead, I think things are only going to get worse for those implicated in this report and their networks, because it even has broader investigatory powers and probably more time. Well, it's only got 6 months, so maybe not much more time, but it will put a lot of people on the dock, and people implicated in these reports will be publicly questioned. Day after day, they will come under heavy scrutiny. And I do not think that will be good for both allegations of misuse of state power or corruption, as well as for ANC leaders, as the perception that really affected them in these local government elections of just this arrogance and distrust. I think if this inquiry goes ahead with these issues and we have the same leaders who are sitting there, you know, on TV being faced with these extremely critical questions, I really think it will be a negative for the ANC come 2019 elections.
And there you have it. The drama that is national politics here continues, and we still, of course, have the situation between the Hawks and the NPA and the finance minister, and that's something that we'll make sure to keep talking about and watching. Just to change focus slightly, we're going to be talking a bit about Gambia. the West African nation that has elections coming up in December, so in just a few weeks. And we'll be speaking to Human Rights Watch, who've done an extremely comprehensive and detailed report about the electoral environment going into the elections. And there's some really worrying findings around freedom of press, freedom of opposition parties, and just really the ability of a free and fair election to take place. For this, we'll be speaking to Jim Wormington, who's a researcher in the Africa division with a big, big focus on West Africa. Jim, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you very well. Thanks for having me.
So, Jim, I mean, just mentioning this detailed report that you've been a part of working on around the Gambia electoral process and electoral sort of road to the elections in December. One thing you looked into was the allegations of intimidation, violence, and kidnapping of opposition leaders. Could you tell us a bit about your findings on that?
Sure. No, the election is December 1st, so as you say, in a few weeks. But as we look back at what's happened, it's important to go back to April of this year, when an opposition activist called Solo Sandeng went out into the street with a banner that said, "We demand electoral reform." So basically calling for a more level playing field for opposition parties to contest the election. The sort of thing you see routinely in South Africa or in more freer countries. But in that case, Solo was arrested. He was taken to the headquarters of Gambia's intelligence agency, and later that night he was beaten to death. That led to a much wider crackdown on members of Solo Sandeng's party, which is called the United Democratic Party, the largest in Gambia, including the arrest of the party's leader and much of its executive, and then 30 members of the UDP, including the leader, were sentenced to three-year jail terms, basically for having gone out into the street peacefully and to demand justice for the death of Solo Sandeng. So this is a situation that has been certainly worsened since April, but it's also important to point out that President Jammeh has been in power since the 1994 coup. This is the fifth election that he's contested, and each time there's been a pattern that as the election approaches, there's a wider crackdown on opposition and really any dissenting voices. So it's a situation that is becoming critical as the election approaches, and we'll be watching very closely in the next few weeks.
You've also mentioned that there's very limited room for opposition parties to actually even campaign, just in terms of time allocated legally and also in terms of media that's willing to carry their message on air, on the newspapers and so on.
Yeah, it's a very challenging context for opposition. I mean, you have a context in which President Jammeh has complete control of the state apparatus, state media, civil servants and the army routinely accompany him as he campaigns, even before the official election campaign begins. You see these striking images of Jammeh with a huge entourage of army and civil servants following behind him. And then in contrast, you have opposition groups who, if they want to organize a rally, for example, have to get a permit from the very government that they're seeking to challenge. Those permits often take a few weeks to get and sometimes are denied. And so they just face sort of bureaucratic obstacles for going out into the streets. And then they have no access to state media and to state radio, which is in a country that is not highly educated, is really a key medium for getting access to voters. So as you look at the picture, you have this entrenched regime that's been in power for a long time, which is willing to use all of the state's resources to support its own candidate. And on the other side, you have an opposition who faces intimidation, who lives under a climate of fear, and yet at the same time has little access to state media and radio. So it's a really challenging context for opposition, without question.
You've mentioned just in a previous answer that that President Jammeh came into power in a coup in 1994. He had promised to step aside after 3 months to allow for elections, and clearly still hasn't done that. Do you think that moment when the coup leader who became president did not step down, do you think that was the turning point when alarm bells should have been going off? Or do you think over time he's gotten progressively worse and perhaps it's been a gradual increase in terms of the dictatorship and the brutality?
I think it's difficult to relativize the government's record of abuses, because without question there have been moments pretty much throughout President Jammeh's time in power when the security forces have resorted to excessive force and killed or tortured and disappeared protesters. I think what's important to say is that each election cycle, and there's been five as I said, we've seen this pattern of intimidation of the opposition and a lack of a real free space for a contest. In 2011, for example, ECOWAS, which is the regional actor in West Africa, refused to even observe the election because they felt like that election was so tainted by intimidation. So I think that in a way, each of these elections had the potential to be a key moment in giving Gambians the chance to really pass an objective judgment on Jammeh's record in government. But they've been denied that opportunity on five separate occasions. And so I think what's important to note is that this election is becoming in a way a little different to others, because you have a united opposition, seven opposition parties who've come together to name a single candidate. And so while there is another opposition party, Jammeh will only face essentially two opposition groupings as he contests the election, a far more cohesive opposition than he's seen before. So I think the potential for a sort of more contested process is there, but there's also certainly the potential for the government to resort to a crackdown even more than they have done so far this year if the election becomes more closely contested.
Now, Jim, you've mentioned that Gambia is part of the economic community of West African states, and they've all adopted a good governance sort of framework that they're all supposed to comply with. Clearly, Gambia isn't complying with. What do you think is the role of these other member states in West Africa of putting pressure on Gambia to comply and sort of free up the electoral process? What do you think is their role in that, and how effective do you think that could be as an incentive, or I suppose disincentive, to continue as they've been?
Well, first of all, I think they have a huge role to play. I think that ECOWAS is in many ways a very progressive regional grouping, with the ECOWAS Community Court of Justice, which has a strong human rights jurisdiction and has passed some really important human rights cases, including, for example, on the disappearance of journalists in Gambia. And the Good Governance Protocol was a real commitment. It was supposed to almost be kind of a constitutional document for West Africa that sets out the rules, for example, on elections, that there shouldn't be coups and that elections should be free and fair. So given that commitment, we're basically asking, and many Gambians are asking, ECOWAS to live up to the reputation that it has to some extent deservedly built. That means making very strong and robust statements against Gambia, including by other heads of state in ECOWAS. We haven't really seen that yet. In the June ECOWAS Heads of State Summit, they called on Gambia to respect, for example, the rights of opposition, but didn't really condemn what had already been a pretty atrocious year for human rights in Gambia. And then, as with many countries that work on Gambia, it's important for them to go beyond just robust rhetoric and really move towards something that demonstrates to the government that human rights abuses have real consequences. For example, ECOWAS, if there is a violation, as you rightly say, there clearly is, of the Good Governance Protocol, ECOWAS does have sanctions that it can apply against Gambia, including even suspension of Gambia from ECOWAS decision-making bodies, or failures to back Gambians for international posts in the UN and other bodies. It's absolutely clear, in our opinion, that given how little impact has been had so far from the sorts of statements that we've seen from ECOWAS, but even from the AU and the European Union, the US, that the government isn't going to change purely on the basis of statements. And so at this point, it's important that people look towards sanctions.
And just on this, on the topic of regulatory bodies and continental ones, what do you think about the role of the African Union? They've sometimes come under fire for inaction on Ethiopia, Burundi, or just not being tough enough and not willing to, for different member states and presidents not being willing to condemn each other and come out strongly against each other. Do you think there's a role for the African Union to play in this?
No, absolutely. There is certainly, as a sort of backup and a complement to what ECOWAS itself is doing as the regional body. I mean, in some ways, Gambia is quite a specific case for the AU, because the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, sort of a court-like judicial body that oversees the human rights record and sort of supervises the human rights record of African states, that's actually based in Banjul. The African Charter on Human and People's Rights is known as the Banjul Charter, Banjul being the capital of Gambia. So there's a real sort of obligation on the African Commission and on the AU, which it's part of, to be almost particularly diligent on Gambia, so that the fact that the commission is not based there is not this huge contradiction given Gambia's human rights record. We've seen in April that the African Commission did make a strong statement on Gambia. They should continue to do that, and they should be stronger in arguing that the AU itself and the groups of states within the AU both make stronger statements like ECOWAS on Gambia, but also start to apply real pressure on Gambia at the Peace and Security Council, for example, to take action to address these these human rights abuses.
And next, just on the topic of the international community, I'd like to ask about the European Union and the US. You mentioned in your report that the EU has taken some steps in terms of sort of withdrawing some development funding from the government and channeling it through non-state actors. Do you think those kinds of measures are effective? So the EU and the US perhaps either withdrawing completely or diverting funding to Gambia, or some kinds of travel bans and any other sanctions. Do you think those kinds of measures would be effective in terms of getting the Gambian electoral process to open up?
Well, as I say, we certainly feel that at this point the rhetoric and condemnation of countries is important, but isn't enough. Human Rights Watch doesn't, in this case, argue that there be economic sanctions on Gambia. Those, as we've seen in other countries, tend to affect ordinary Gambians more than they affect the elite and the government. But we certainly think that things like asset freezes for government officials that are implicated in human rights abuses, travel bans, would be very significant. I think in some ways Gambia sort of represents perhaps something that we've seen in other countries, where you have the EU and the US taking an engagement approach, trying to have dialogue with the Gambian government, thinking that they can very slowly move President Jammeh and his entourage towards a more open and progressive human rights stance. But in reality, we're looking here at a government that's been in power for 22 years, where there's been this sort of cycle of an election, abuses before an election, and then an attempt to engage Jammeh when the election is over. And it's clear at this point that that approach just doesn't work, and you need to have something that you're holding as a backup to the rhetoric that you're saying, and some sort of stick, if you like, to follow the carrot. And in our opinion, those types of asset freezes and visa bans that really focus on specific individuals are really effective, because they don't affect ordinary Gambians, and they affect the people who are benefiting economically from this government.
The more we talk about it, it seems like a really, really tough situation. I mean, in the most mildest terms, it just seems like almost unresolvable. I mean, you have the president saying Ban Ki-moon can go to hell, calling Westerners vermin, saying he's going to bury people 9 feet deep. How hopeful are you that we will see electoral reform and a decrease to brutality and the killings and kidnappings in the future?
Well, I think there's two different scenarios, as you say, the election being December 1st, very close by. I mean, the first is that the opposition are able to win in this upcoming election. Obviously, we wouldn't take a position on how likely that is, but given the challenges that the opposition face, it certainly is an uphill struggle campaigning in elections. Were that to happen, that would create essentially a decision point for President Jammeh as to whether he steps down in a peaceful manner or whether, I think, the risk of conflict and human rights abuses escalates dramatically. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is if President Jammeh wins this election, then I think that the arguments that Human Rights Watch and others are offering are to argue for a sort of increase in civic space, an increase in the space that opposition parties and NGOs and journalists have in Gambia by the US, the AU, the EU, ECOWAS, all putting enough pressure on the Gambian government that slowly you see this opening of civic space, you see this ability of opposition parties and NGOs to challenge the government, and that in itself slowly leads to the kind of opening of a democratic process that would allow for a fairer electoral process in the future. Gambia does have legislative elections next year and local elections the year after, so this is not the only test, this upcoming presidential election. But certainly you're right that either there's a short-term risk of conflict, certainly if Jammeh does refuse to step down, or we're looking at a medium to long-term effort to open up democratic space to allow for a freer and fairer Gambia in the long run.
And Jim, just before I let you go, my final question. I mean, your team interviewed, hundreds of people in the compiling of this report, and had just so many stories from people in Gambia, people who've had to flee to Senegal, and so on. And I'd love if you could just tell us, one of their stories, just to sort of humanize the issue somewhat. What are some of the challenges that you and your team are hearing from just regular Gambians who are not that interested in politics and just trying to earn a living and survive? What are some of the issues that they're facing in the backdrop to this elections?
Sure. I mean, I think perhaps the most powerful story, which I can also connect to ordinary Gambians, is that of Fatoumata Sandeng, who was the daughter of Solo Sandeng, who was the opposition activist beaten to death in April, which really began this latest crackdown. Her family, and she has eight siblings and a mother, her family immediately went out onto the streets to call for their father's body to be released and for information about how he died, information that they still haven't had, and they still haven't had the body. And then the police visited their house and threatened them, and they were forced to leave Gambia, leave the country that they had their uncles and aunties and relatives in, that they knew. You know, imagine a mother who's just lost her husband with nine children and having to flee in secret to a country nearby to Gambia, and now living in a very, if you like, sort of downtrodden compound, relying on the diaspora and others to support them. Just such a stark change to a very middle-class, successful family who had just by chance become political activists, and the impact on them of the death of their father and the subsequent intimidation that they suffered by the police has been extraordinary and really both tragic to witness, but incredible because the family shows such courage and grace given what they've been through. And I think that point, the fact that so many Gambians have had to leave Gambia, I think is what perhaps is the biggest illustration of the tragedy that the country faces. You have people leaving like the Sandengs because of abuses that they and their family have faced. But you also have a huge number, an extraordinary number, really, compared to the size of Gambia, of young men in particular taking what they call the back way up through North Africa to seek economic opportunity in Europe. Many of those people are leaving for economic reasons rather than the oppression that the government places upon people. But clearly the lack of an open democratic space and the lack of really just an openness to the international community from Gambia has an impact on its economic situation. So I think it's that really illustrates the tragedy and the struggle that many Gambians face.
Jim, thank you so much. We'll continue to watch as we go into December, and please keep up the excellent work.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. That was an interview with Jim Wormington, who's a researcher in the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch and focused specifically on West Africa. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Conversations about the American elections, state capture here at home, and the elections coming up in Gambia in December. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Please make sure to share the podcast far and wide. We'll see you next week. Daily Maverick Show, 1 to 2 p.m. every Tuesday.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.